Hello, everyone. This is John Farrell, senior editor for Tabletop at GamingTrend.com. This is the second in a series of interviews I am doing with tabletop designers about their process. I am joined by Luke Crane, who you would probably know best from Burning Wheel, which has also been expanded on a few times, and into Mouse Guard, which is its own supplement where you play as small woodland creatures having adventures.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
And Burning Wheel is interesting to me. What's most interesting about it is that it's a game that is driven by your character's beliefs and their relationships. When you are making a character, you take a life path system, so you chart their early and middle years of life, see what their interests are, and how those influence their current beliefs. How is that a design philosophy you came upon to make the game driven by a character's history and beliefs and relationships rather than mechanical drive?
Yeah, it came up through play and the way my group developed these priorities around some of the other games we were playing, AD&D or Star Wars or Shadowrun at the time. But it also came up from reading literature, reading especially Le Guin, Earthsea. Like in The Farthest Shore, the third book of the Earthsea trilogy, Ged says some incredible stuff. He expresses his beliefs about himself and sorcery and life and death, and I just was just hungry for that. I wanted that in RPGs. How do we get past just killing stuff for gain, which just seemed gross to me, and get into these moments where a character is challenged over what they believe, they express what they believe, and that becomes what the game is about.
It's great to hear that Ursula Le Guin was an influence. You know, she, just like Burning Wheel, are a different voice in fantasy that I think people would benefit a lot from having some experience with. And your games have a lot of moving parts that they need to be analyzed, and I'm sure were difficult to playtest with. What was the timeline like for playtesting them?
For Burning Empires and Mouse Guard, we did everything in about 8 months, where from concept to shipping the file off to the printer. So we did playtesting, I think, in about 3 months for those, independent playtesting. Right. We did internal playtesting through the whole time. And that's where we asked people to play a single session or, you know, a group of sessions. And I also learned that we want to, for our games, we want to test in flights of three. I read this really great advice at some point during our design process years ago that said three people, three groups or whatever is enough to get 80% of the problems, and that you're wasting resources if you're, you know, testing in bigger flights. Like basically test in flights of three, take the most prevalent problems, then go to the next flight, you know, after you've iterated. And so once we started doing that, we were able to do things very efficiently because we were able to, you know, maximize available groups and get quite a bit of information and refinement very quickly.
At first, I was surprised to hear that, but then I think about it. If it's three groups, you know, you're depending on how many people you have, it's like 12 to 15, which are going to be different perspectives and a lot of people looking at similar encounters because the groups will be at the table together, but they'll... It's already surprising just how different players can outthink you when you're running a game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, like, you know, one group might miss a thing, but if two groups are picking up on a problem, it's a problem. Like, just, I don't need 10 groups to tell me it's a problem. If two groups are telling me, then I need to figure it out.
And the adage I've heard about playtesting is that people are very good at finding problems, but they're not as good at solving them. I guess because they don't have as much context for how the rest of the game is built.
Oh, yeah. It's rough. We rarely ask people for how they would solve a problem. We really try to focus on what happened.
Yeah.
What did you do? And especially if you encountered something, how did you feel? Like, you... Some people encounter a flaw in the design and they feel great about it. They're like, ha-ha, I found an exploit. But other people, like, it, you know, they feel it ruined the game.
Interesting. And it's something that I think would make it so much harder to test for than, like, in a video game, it's very binary. Does this thing work as intended? In an RPG, you're trying to cover a much wider spectrum of experience, you know, and how people interact with the fiction.
Yeah, I told my students it's to imagine kind of a probability cone where the base of the cone is the game, and then the far end of the cone is deep play of the game, really expert campaigns worth of play, and then the inside the cone are your expected results. And you don't want to make the cone too narrow for expected results, because then play feels very samey. It feels restricted or claustrophobic. And you don't want to make the cone so wide that the players feel like there's no point in playing this particular game because it feels like all other games. But, when you're designing here, you'll never be able to restrict all results into your cone of expected results. There'll always be a few things that fall outside. Or fall beyond. And I actually think that it's great. I think it's a testament to how robust the play space and design space of role-playing games is. But most of their results, like 80, 90% of the results, have to be falling within their expectations for the design.
It's an interesting problem that you raise, that like you're trying to use mechanics to both drive decision-making but also map decision-making. And you can never totally map how people will interact with the world, because you can't make a mechanic for everything.
Well, yes and no. This is another thing that I really troll my students with. I tell them they better have a mechanic for everything, and they start to freak out. They're like, "What?" And they start to imagine these encyclopedia rule books and whatnot. They look at my games and they're like, "I can't write that," because they have to do all this in a semester. But what I mean when I say that is that if the game is producing all these unanticipated results, what's going on? Why is it doing that? Why is it allowing the players to just fly around and do whatever they want and have this undirected play? But a really good game will make you feel like your actions are credible, your choices are credible, even when it's restricting you in your choices. You won't feel restricted. You'll feel like, oh yeah, this is the right thing to do.
It's definitely interesting that you also bring up teaching design, because although I understand certain aspects of design and how you can learn to be better at it and learn from existing games, I am curious how you try to put together something like an academic syllabus around game design and what sources you pull from. And also, it's not something that I think is the scholarship on it is new, which is to say there isn't that much on the theory of it and how it actually works and affects people.
Yeah, I mean, ludography has been growing in the past century, but it is still fairly new. It's a new discipline, and the way we play games as a culture is relatively new too. Just maybe since the 19th century, and role playing games obviously being incredibly young. So for my class, I teach a design focused class rather than a survey or history. I pick out mechanics or portions of games and then use existing texts as examples of them. For the setting portion of a game, we might look at Cyberpunk, but for like a currency system part of a game, we compared the One Ring and Mouse Guard, and how the One Ring uses hope and despair, and how Mouse Guard uses rewards and checks in order to drive play. Yeah, and then we try to have the students create their own versions of these systems. And then in my class, they have to create 3 games in the semester, because I think that's just the best way to learn, is to look at examples and then try to do it yourself.
What kinds of games have they been making? I'm sure there's been at least one gem from all of them.
Oh, there have been a few gems.
Last semester, one of the students designed a game based on Robert Frost's Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening or Snowy Night.
Interesting.
But he turned it into kind of a survival horror folktale. Awesome stuff. Really good.
That sounds really... Is that something that you think that person might be interested in releasing? That sounds really interesting.
I am strongly encouraging Graham to release this. Graham, if you're out there, let's go.
I mean, if nothing else, the pitch is like nothing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, it's great. And like, he has a cold mechanic where the, as the night goes on, the cold is increasing and it has these different costs, and each traveler through the wood is a different reason for trying to reach the other side. It's sweet. It's really good.
Cool. I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye out for that one. That sounds great.
Awesome. Yeah. And then early on, maybe the first semester, we had a one-page game where, and the conceit of the one-page game design is that they can't use a table in play, right? They have to stand up, and that, you know, they're not supposed to be rolling dice on the table. And so one group came up with a superhero game in which the resolution involved gestural mechanics, where they had to gesture their superpowers. It was delightful. A complete broken mess, but hilarious.
Oh, yeah. And some of the best art is composed of broken messes. But it is... We're at an interesting time in role-playing because it's expanding in terms of who's getting into it and the kinds of things they're doing. You know, solo journaling RPGs were not a thing, and now tons of people are making them. And so something I'm interested in, because I have not heard this really from other people, and you're in a great position to talk about it, is what it takes to make an RPG, not just in terms of the design, but getting the actual product out there. I know one of the reasons people say it's hard to make a profit is because it's niche, and also that publishing is expensive, getting good art is expensive, and getting layout is, you know, it's difficult to bring all those things together and then also get it out to a wide audience.
Yeah, the economics of role-playing game design and book publishing are just brutal. And you know, you can squeak it out if you have a mid-sized loyal audience that's willing to buy everything you release. But really, it's funny, in the last year or so, I've realized that we're all just creating, like when we create a fan of our games, we're really just creating a fan of Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast, you know, someone who's eventually going to get sucked into the D&D ecosystem. It's kind of depressing.
And right now, I have no idea how widespread it is, because there's nothing like a comprehensive look at how RPG players are playing, but it seems like there's a large, vocal, purposeful pushback against Wizards of the Coast that still isn't having that much of an impact on how things are actually sold.
Right. The diversity of games right now is out of this world. It's incredible. The formats, the content, the systems, the creators, all this stuff. It's just this beautiful field of gems that are being experimented with and you know, brought out to folks, and I'm delighted by it. But the only person really, or only entity making money from this in any meaningful way is Wizards.
And it's unfortunate that being the case, they still aren't making a lot of decisions that could make them more money. They're going about it in a cheap way, but not doing things like making supplementary products to their games that people would want to buy, that plenty of other people are selling that do really well. You know, if you are playing Pathfinder, you can pay like $20 for good cardboard standouts of every character and NPC and monster that you will meet in one of their adventures, which makes you want to get more things.
Yeah, Wizards is going to move away from that into digital products, I think. That's my guess, is they're going to move away from even paper products entirely within the next few years and focus on, just purely digital products.
Yeah. It does concern me that, I think it was their CEO, I will fact check myself on that later on, who said, we want more of the recurrent spending that you get from video games, because video game publishers don't treat their audiences very well, and they don't treat their products very well, and they certainly don't treat their staff well. So if D&D wants to move in that direction, then I believe them.
Yeah. So in my case, though, there's these very strange dynamics of, you know, making a game, and the game is going to inhabit the form of a book, physical good, and has to be manufactured somewhere, and then has to be shipped to me. And we have a warehouse where our products go to now, and rather than just my office. And then from the warehouse, we have people that repackage those things to be sent out to folks who buy them from us individually, or to distributors who want to order them from us. And, you know, moving physical goods around the world in the volume of thousands, you know, at a time, right? We sell maybe 5,000 books a year, or maybe between 5 and 10, depending. And it's just very expensive and ultimately very low margins. And so it's a difficult business. And, you know, I can sell someone a book that, you know, at the time of the exchange actually returns a decent amount of money to me and the company. But that person, the thing, especially for our games, like that person has got an item of incredible value, and they can basically sit and play that game for the rest of their lives, and they don't have to give me another penny, which I am all down for, but it just means that I have to continually expand my audience in order to stay in business, or I have to find new products to keep selling to that person, and then the decay on that is massive.
Yes, and we've seen that plenty of times with crashes of all sorts of different RPG lines, because they have to keep making stuff and it breaks down eventually. Do you see it changing, that the distribution model of mostly doing things by books? Do you think people will do more pure PDF releases, or is part of the point that it's like a premium product? I own this physical object that is well made and I can use as a reference material.
I think that there are multiple audiences or segments of the audience, depending on how you want to view it. And I think the collector segment is very powerful, and they want the beautiful thing. They want to have the object. They want to collect it. They want to fawn over it, you know, maybe read it, maybe not. And then, you know, there's another segment that just wants digital stuff. They want it from us or from Itch or DriveThruRPG or something, and they just want to you know, play through the digital device. Or some of them are even collectors in that mindset. And then there's even the most curious of this and the most elusive chimeras of the RPG audience, and those are the people who still shop at their favorite local game stores and buy books off the shelf. And I just want to say to you all out there, I love you. And I don't know who most of you are. 99% of you, I have no idea who you are. And I think you're great.
you're the salt of the earth, keeping these poor indie designers in business.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like, that person doesn't make me as much money as someone who buys it direct from me at a con or at a, you know, off my store. But they're having a very genuine interaction here. They're supporting me, they're supporting the game store, and they're like going someplace and like looking at picking a book up off the shelf and looking at it and saying, oh, cool, yeah. Or maybe they've heard of it, maybe they haven't. And then they're saying, this is worth my time, I'm gonna get this right now. Like, I just think it's magical.
This the one occasion when maybe it's a good idea to judge a book by its cover. Which helps when you have the cover art of Burning Wheel. And one, I'm not sure how much it affects the thinking or the economics. I'm not sure if you can determine it. But do you think that an element of this issue is piracy in the RPG community? I don't want to mention anything specifically, but I know for a while there was a resource people used pretty freely to illegally pirate books and share them with one another.
Yeah, well, the uncomfortable truth is piracy hurts small publishers. Like, any time that you're not giving them $10 for this game or whatever, it hurts a small publisher. There's just no two ways about it. I also want to say I understand the impulse, and that we are all, or most of us, I guess, are being fucked over by people who we work for and who don't pay us enough money and don't value our labor and our life's blood, that we and so we feel like spending $10 on a luxury good that you could just download for free isn't worth it. I get that. I understand the impulse. Our games were pirated mercilessly from the get-go. Yeah, and it hurt. It felt bad. And we would try to like talk about that in public, and people would get really upset at us.
Well, it is especially a problem when you consider how inexpensive these things can be versus how much it can be, because you really can, if you find a good RPG that you like, just play that for the rest of your life and stop buying other books.
Sure.
It happens all the time.
Sure. Yeah, they're so cheap for what you get. If you look at like a novel, like a hardcover novel from a major publisher, and how much those things cost versus the content that you get in there. You get a novel, cool. Novels are great. I'm not knocking novels. the amount of testing and art and design that needs to go into just the physical object of the book itself for role-playing games is like, you know, in the book world would be like a coffee table book or like, you know, a book that would cost minimum $100. But we don't charge that. And D&D charges, what, $60 a book?
You only have to get three of them and they're selling three more next year.
Right. Oh, man. The RPG world, I've found, is extremely price sensitive. I don't. And y'all, like, I'm on. You can reach me at burningwheel@burningwheel.com if you want to talk to me about this, about your thoughts on, like, $25 versus $35 versus $50 for a game. We've experimented with pricing since the beginning. I originally charged $15 for Burning Wheel for a two-book set. Basically, it cost me $7.50 to make, and I just doubled the price and sold it for that. I didn't know what I was doing. It seemed like I would make my money back plus some. But people, I remember, freelancer on the internet told me that I was stealing bread from the mouths of his family by selling Burning Wheel for that amount of money back in the day.
Wow. That's it's some real imagery for an RPG.
But, you know, we also released like a prestige book that we charged $55 or $60 for. We used the box set in 2010 that we charged $65 for. And people were aghast. Like, we charged like a... Yeah, that box set had tons of material in it, and people were shocked, and it hurt the game. It hurt the sales. But Dungeon World, which I publish, still sells for $25, and it sells gangbusters, but we make no money on that per unit. Only by volume do we make any money, because it's so expensive to keep a book in print.
Yeah, that sounds like, from the publishers I've talked to, the biggest issue is just the act of printing a book, not only to mention layout, and the better you want a book to look, the more difficult it will be to get it laid out, and either one person is doing all the work or you're hiring more people, and it's not, because it's such a niche thing, it's difficult to get it out to enough people to then return that investment, but it's
right.
Also,
you can
it's expensive
get...
just to keep it. Just to sell it, because you have to make it and transport it.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And selling to your, like, loyal fan base, like on a Kickstarter or a pre-order or something, can pay for that print run and, you know, and then some. It's just what comes after that, warehousing those books, maintaining any kind of staff, investing in your next project, you know, shipping those books around the world. Like, you know, distributors take 59% of your cover price. You know, and the like, so when you look at a book that's, you know, selling for $50, you got to realize that only 41% of that is going to the publisher. The other 59% goes to the retailer and distributor. It's, you know, so you have to make your living on very small margins in role-playing games, which means you need high volume, and the role-playing game world is just small.
It is, it is small. It's growing, but even so, the number of people who are producing games is also growing. So we're getting a greater diversity of product, and we're getting more people who are interested in them. But even so, D&D dominates the market, and then you've got to split whatever's left over into all of the other games, which in some countries is not as bad, but I think in America we're pretty heavily on the Wizards of the Coast pipeline.
I think, yeah, most countries where folks are playing role-playing games significantly. D&D takes a big market share. Not all of them, but most of them. And yeah, the U.S. especially, they dominate the market. I don't even think it's 80-20. I think it's like 90-10 or 95-5 or something in terms of their market share.
That's, you've got to really believe in what you're doing to enter a market like that, to decide I'm going to make a book, I'm going to try to sell it, I know that I'm fighting for some percentage of 10% of the market because this thing that I'm making is good, and you hope it makes an impact. It's kind of impossible to tell with an RPG because it's not just something, they don't just read it like a book or watch it like a movie, they are experiencing it.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, I entered very naively, just thinking, I just want to make this game and get it out there. I mean, hell, I was ready to give it away, and my friends, you know, made me stop and sell it. which was the right thing to do, but the economics of it are brutal. I remember, I think it was Steve Long of Hero Publishing once accused me of running a hobby business, and I was so offended at the time. I was like, how dare you? And now I look back and I'm like, oh, that's because he was right. I was running a hobby business because I couldn't pay anyone's wages, let alone my own. Even though my game was successful, well-regarded, sold a lot of copies, and we even made some money, but it still wasn't anything that could support anyone. It was a hobby.
Yeah. And how have you been surprised over the years how deep into it you've gotten? I mean, it sounds like you weren't sure you were going to make it, and now you've gotten several game lines. Mouse Guard has got its own sort of franchise that's developing. As in the world of RPGs, Burning Wheel has gotten very large.
We have assumed sort of a cult status, I think. You know, we have a bit of legend about us, but we're not as big as people think we are. And I don't know. I guess I was of two minds. There was one Luke that was like, this is never going to work, and this is going to crash and burn. And there was another Luke who was like, we're going to fucking be on top. And so neither of those Lukes was right. And, you know, we've entered into this other phase. I just had to make a lot of decisions about how to stay in business, how to be successful, how to, like, keep my values, you know, in play. And, you know, and so I decided to just kind of walk, you know, down a very thoughtful path, I would say. You know, we never splashed out for big booths at any of the cons. We always keep a humble presence there. And I just would never let us overreach. I always tried to make sure that we could afford whatever we were risking. You know, even if when some of the things didn't pay off, it still stung. But so yeah, and that resulted in us, one, we didn't burn out, but two, we also never really swung for the fences. Mouse Guard's very successful, and I'm very pleased with Mouse Guard and its long life. But Mouse Guard's published by Arkea, and that means I see, you know, smaller returns than if I published it myself. But I mean, that has its trade-offs. Like, having somebody else handle all the logistics is nice sometimes.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people don't understand. It's not just writing a book and laying it out. You have to continue to be involved with it. Even if you just want to sort of release one print run and let it have its life, there are a lot of decisions you have to make to get it out, get it to people, and even things like how printing a book works, you have to learn some things about that you wouldn't think would be relevant, except it becomes really important when you're releasing it as a physical product.
Absolutely. Yeah, I actually taught myself desktop publishing before, you know, releasing Burning Wheel, because I knew that I wanted to make this book, and I just didn't feel like going to a publisher was a realistic aim, and I think I was right. And so I figured I was going to have to DIY it. And so, yeah, I, like, stayed late after work and taught myself Quark Express and Illustrator and Photoshop so that I could make this dumb game and get it out there. But you bring up an interesting point that it's once the game's out there, it's not enough to just release it and throw it into people's hands. You have to, especially as a small press publisher, you have to be able to do your own marketing, which means in terms of what we do, it largely means going and talking to people about your game. And you have to also be your own best game master or your own best player of this game, and you have to support the game at events or online. You have to just keep playing the game over and over with people. And this is an interesting bit of, like, background count that I did not anticipate as we started to release, you know, different variations, different lines, different games over the years, that supporting one game, even, you know, a game with, like, five books out, like we had with Burning Wheel Revised, was easy compared to supporting six different game lines, where it's just impossible to keep focus and remember all of the rules and all the vagaries and the release schedules, and it's just different.
Does this affect your play of the game, the fact that there are all these other logistical elements, when you're actually like sitting down, and because I imagine a movie actor, when they're watching the movie, they can't really enjoy it because they're remembering, like, that was the day it was really hot, my suit didn't fit right, and then we did this take like 50 times.
I guess it affects my play of the game in a couple ways. One, after a certain point, once, you know, we had the game published, especially when we hit like the Burning Wheel revised period and after, when we would be playing the games here at Burning Wheel headquarters, and they would look at me and they'd start yelling at me about something or arguing with me, I'd be like, I don't fucking care. Look at the rules. What does the book say? Don't argue with me. And like, Anthony's the game master. I'm not the game master. What are you fucking doing? Like, talk to Anthony. The book's there. Look it up yourself. Right. And so like, it allowed me to like step back and create some remove as the designer, which I really quite liked. But the other side of it is that I tend to look at most of the games I play in of my own games as play tests. And I can never completely just dive into my own stuff because I'm always monitoring the situation with the game and the rules and the text and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, why did it take him so long to find that? Or like, if someone's looking something up, or, you know, or this rule felt good yesterday, but it felt bad today. Why? That kind of stuff. So yeah, I feel maybe like a cook who, or, you know, or someone who loves food, who's become a cook and kind of ruined food for themselves.
Yeah, you want not to be a snob, but I have the same thing where, like, I've read and played so many RPGs that sometimes you're playing one and I want to be in the fiction, but you're just like, that's an interesting resolution system for that. But it is a good time, as difficult as it is to make games. A lot of people are making games and they're really experimenting and doing new things. And to the listeners, if you haven't played or at least read Burning Wheel, I would really recommend it as a different approach to how what you're trying to accomplish in an RPG. It's driven more by the things that would drive a character than it is by the mechanical aspect of trying to get more powerful and obtain new abilities.
Yeah, thank you. It's also a different relationship between the game master and the players. The game presupposes this position where the game master is asking the players what they care about, with the idea that the things that they put forth will become the game in one form or another. They'll represent challenges or obstacles that the players encounter. And it's, so it's not about the game master's story or meta plot or some pre-published adventure. It starts from this very collaborative frame. Now the game master is allowed to have an opinion, and they're allowed to like emphasize some things, de-emphasize others, or, you know, they're allowed to surprise and delight. The players don't dictate what's going to happen. They say, hey, I care about this, so please challenge it, and play proceeds from there. And then it becomes, as you said, about the internal life of the characters as they deal with these challenges.
And it's easier to run a game that way, even though it might not seem like it at first, because there's less that you have to worry about preparing. It evolves naturally from what the characters want to accomplish and what issues that might come up with trying to accomplish those things naturally.
Yeah, I agree. I think the early on prep of creating the world situation and some of the antagonists and whatnot, I mean, I think it's comparable to other games. Maybe not, it's not like drawing a mega dungeon or anything, but it definitely requires some sit down and some like game master thinky homework. But once the game is running, like, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of like, you know, we're sitting down and thinking about what happened last session and, you know, what obstacles are going to, you know, confront the players this session is about all I ever need.
I'm sure you worked on this for a while with many different aspects to the mechanics, because Burning Wheel has different, more complicated resolution systems as you learn more of the game. How did it change through the process of conceptualizing and playtesting it as you were balancing all of these things together?
Oh, it changed a lot from the first versions in like the mid to late 90s to where it is now. I'm going to try to find a specific example here, but But my goal was always to listen to the players and try to see what they were, you know, struggling with and trying to accomplish at the table, and see if we could design into that, around it, toward it, or whatever. Like, try to basically turn their good ideas or their struggles into systems that could repeat that behavior. I mean, one of the early inspirations was actually playing Shadowrun with my dear friend Rich, and he, you know, we're playing one of the modules, Bottle Demon or something, and there's a character, Michael Dumont, and Rich just was screaming, like, you know, about how his character was going to hang Michael Dumont from a lamppost because he was, you know, so infuriated by my villainous play of him. And I remember stopping and thinking, that is incredible. Because he pulled it off. He actually did it. And that's incredible. Like, how do we get that into a game? Like, how do we have him say something so cool and impassioned, like, set it down and say, like, yeah, let's do this. What is this all about? And we did it. We really did that. Through playtesting, you know, obviously playtesting the life paths, like, looking for optimal paths, or what players think are optimal paths, or where they're creating these distortions where players are feel like they need to take this certain weird life path in order to get a certain build. Those sometimes they actually find weird optimizations that we need to fix. Other times the optimizations are intentional, where we're like, yeah, that's just a good plan for this type of character. But other times there's a meta is developed by the community, and they think that something's like the way to do it, and we're like, okay, we got to fix this because it's not the way to do it, and we don't know why you're doing this.
I hadn't thought of that either, that when you're having a continual relationship with an RPG that you've designed, people are going to find new things to interpret, new ways to break the rules as you're going on. Like, you're never really done playtesting it.
We opened up a Discord this year, and we've been pretty reclusive, I don't know, for the past 5 years or so. And finally, we decided to, like, kind of step back into the community limelight by opening a Discord. And it's been great because we're back in touch with that type of interaction, where we're watching people discuss, like, what we think are very simple and self-evident rules, and they're, like, twisting themselves all around them. And we're like, how? How it says, you know, X, Y, Z, how are you getting ABC? But right, like, we've got to listen, and we've got to really think that through. And, like, cause, like you said, you know, we're always designing now.
Well, and I'm sorry to say, or I'm glad to say, probably both, that the journey never ends. You're never going to be done with Burning Wheel. And I've had you for close to an hour, so I think I'm going to try to wrap up.
You're probably true.
Is there anywhere people should be looking to find you or your work so that I can share those links below this recording?
Oh, sure. Burningwheel.com for our landing page and store. There's also a newsletter sign up there, which I encourage y'all to sign up for. We send newsletters once every few months, and we usually do really cool stuff in our newsletters. So sign up there. We're going to be releasing more video content, so you can follow our Burning Wheel YouTube channel, which I can give you a link to. And and if you write me at burningwheel@burningwheel.com, I will give you a link to the Discord.
Great. Thanks a lot. I will make sure to join that Discord because I'm going to be trying to play more Burning Wheel in the new year. Who knows? Organizing people is difficult. But thank you so much, Luke Crane, for joining me tonight. It's been lovely talking to you, and I want to get more into the supplements. I've played Burning Wheel, but not as much Burning Sands or Mouse Guard, and I want to change that soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to chat.